Hello, my name is Glyn Bolton. I am the investment director here at Clarity. And in this podcast recording, I'm going to be talking to Joe
Hello.
about equities, which, of course, is an enormous subject, but we'll try and give you a little background.
Clarity On is brought to you by Clarity, experts in strategic financial planning and investment management. With over 25 years of experience in the field, our award-winning team are well-positioned to help people navigate the complex world of finance.
So, Joe, what is it you would like to know about equities from your point of view?
Well, I hear about them a lot, so first of all, just wanting to know what they actually are.
Yeah, it's a very good question. A lot of people bandy the word equity around without really understanding what equity means. Equity means a piece or a share. Equity and share are two interchangeable words. Basically, if you hold an equity, you hold a share in a business. So if you've got one share in AstraZeneca, you own a very, very small share of the massive AstraZeneca conglomerate. And you will be invited as a shareholder to come to shareholders' meetings, should you wish to do so, and hear the directors explain profit and loss, etc., etc. When most people think about shares, they think about publicly traded companies. They think about big companies like AstraZeneca, as I mentioned, and Shell and Amazon and Tesla and those kind of firms. Most people don't think about shares of smaller, unquoted companies like Clarity. But most companies have shareholders of some kind. And the reason people invest in shares is because it gives them a little piece of the performance of that underlying company. Of course, as I learned at financial planning school many, many years ago, shares are volatile. Some shares are more volatile than others. If you look at shares in, for instance, Tesla's probably a good example. If you look at the shares of Tesla, if you bought them 5 years ago, you'd be doing quite well. If you bought them 2 years ago, you'd have lost something like 40% of your money, I think.
Right.
So shares go up and down, particularly shares in volatile markets like tech stocks and things like that. Tech stocks can be far more volatile than other types of shares like mining companies or oil companies, which can be rather more reliable and solid. So share, a piece of a company. You own a little piece of someone else's company.
Okay. So from my understanding, they seem to have a higher potential return than other investments, which I imagine comes with higher risks. So what are some of the investment strategies employed to mitigate these risks and provide higher returns?
So yeah, equities are far more volatile than cash or bond investments or investments in property. But, volatility can be your friend. We've talked about volatility, I think, in previous podcasts. If a share is volatile, it doesn't matter unless you want your money back. So if you're a short-term investor, you don't want to be invested in shares because they go up, they go down, and nobody can really tell you what the stock market's going to do from one moment to the next. The current period we're going through, the stock market looks very rosy, but nobody can really explain exactly why the stock market does what it does, because it's based upon sentiment. Does that answer your question? Or is that...
Yeah, it covers some of it. I've also heard of some strategies involving like geographic diversification.
Oh, I see what you mean, yes. So people will hold portfolios of shares. Historically, go back to my kind of grandfather's time, people who were investing money would buy portfolios of shares. There weren't any other instruments available. And they would mix them up. So they would look at their exposure to different markets in geographic terms. So they'd say, okay, how much do I want to be exposed to the Middle East? How much do I want to be exposed to the UK? And people historically would seek exposure to their own market, typically, the market they knew well, and they might have a little bit of international exposure. Investors these days will often follow trends, and there's a current trend towards being very heavily overweight the US market because everybody's very excited about what's going on in the United States and their economy. But typically, if you've got a portfolio of equities or other equity-based investments like unit trusts or OEICs, then that will be described in the literature you receive in geographical terms. So they will say you've got 25% invested in the UK, 25% invested in the US, etc. And it's a way of breaking down the underlying investment or breaking down the portfolio. Geographic investment is, or geographic descriptions of your investment portfolio are by some considered to be a little bit old hat these days, because people these days often look at markets. So for instance, if you look at banks, so if you had, when we had the banking crisis back in 2008, if you had a portfolio which was broadly spread across all kinds of different geographic markets, but was invested in banks only, you would have not received any kind of protection, because all of the banks in 2008 in all of the countries had significant problems. So a lot of people these days think about breaking down the portfolio rather geographically into industry sectors. So how much am I in banks? How much am I invested in basic materials? How much am I in manufacturing? How much am I in electricity generation, etc.? And each of those categories tends to have its own particular set of characteristics. So people tend to regard things like utilities, being energy generation or water or something like that, as being relatively stable. And they tend to regard things like IT and then the current kind of mania that we have for artificial intelligence as being rather more exciting.
Yeah, really interesting. I've also heard of the term value investing and growth investing. What's the difference between them two?
They're two traditional investing styles. A value investor would typically buy shares like I just described. So they'll invest in things like utilities and they'll invest in established companies which have established value. So you're buying that company because it has a proven revenue stream and you like the idea of that proven revenue stream that is nice and stable. If you're a growth investor, you will be hoping to ride the market. You'll invest in a stock that is going to grow in value, that you think is going to grow in value. And that price will often go up because lots of other people buy that stock in anticipation of something wonderful happening that hasn't quite happened just yet. And growth investing and value investing have had their day, depending upon exactly what's happening in the market. What was very interesting after COVID was that value investing, having been out of favour for probably 15 years, suddenly returned to form and value stocks started doing very well. For the last 20 years, growth stocks have been in favour most of the time because the financial climate has been very loose. Lots of money was created from the credit crunch, and then during COVID, governments printed lots and lots of money, and there's lots and lots of money around. There's lots of money for new businesses and lots of growth opportunities. A typical growth company would be something like Tesla. A very good kind of description of the value of a share is the price to earnings ratio, which means how much does it cost you for each pound of dividend that it generates. So the price to earnings ratio might be 9 or something for something like Shell or BP. So 9 times earnings is the price, whereas Tesla, I do believe, reached something like 100. So a P of 100 to 1. 100. So you'd have to hold the stock for 100 years to get all your initial price back in dividend. That is a very, very typical growth stock. Yeah, it's worth whatever someone will pay you for it. It can be quite volatile, and it's based upon expectations of future growth. And Elon Musk is particularly good at building up such expectations, as I'm sure you've seen in all his YouTube videos about the great new thing that's coming any minute now. So yeah, growth and value, two very different types of approach. And investment managers typically who run unit trusts and OEICs will often either take a growth or a value-based approach, or they will say that their approach is blended. So a mixture of the two.
Okay. So another strategy I've heard about is passive investing. What are the benefits of this and why might investors choose to use this strategy?
Passive investing, like a lot of fashions in investing, came about when someone looked back at the market and they were looking, this was a chap in America who was looking at the S&P 500, and he looked back and he said, wow, he said, look at my active fund manager. By active fund manager, you mean a man who sits behind a desk, or a woman, of course, who makes decisions on what they're going to buy and picks things for the fund based upon what they think is going to do well in that particular fund. They said, if I, and this chap looked back and said, well, if I had just bought the index, and he was talking about the S&P 500 index, and weighted it according to the size of the companies in the index, I would actually have beaten something like 67% of passive of active managers, and it would have cost me less. So a passive fund will just buy a particular index. It doesn't make any decisions about what it thinks is a good or a bad company. It doesn't involve any kind of thought whatsoever other than simple applications of algorithms. So it buys the index and holds that index and adjusts it as the index changes. So if, for instance, I keep using the example of Tesla, but if they dropped out of the index or went bankrupt, then the passive fund would simply sell all of those shares and replace them with other shares of other companies that were in the index. So people often refer to passive investing as a dumb fund. So it gets you exposure to the market in question. Passive investing is, it won't work in all circumstances. In certain markets, it will be beaten by active investing, particularly there's a lot of turbulence in the market. But a lot of people like it because it's cheap and it does get you exposure to the market. So we tend to use passive funds in the UK and the US because those markets are very well developed and there's an enormous amount of financial information you can use. The problem with passive investing or trying to track an index in a country like Japan or in the Far East or even in Europe is that the information is not quite as good and you'll find that you underperform that particular market. It's far, far easier to outperform the market by investing passively in the UK or the US than it is in any of the other markets. So we tend to avoid passive investing in the other markets, but we do use it with a mixture of judicious active investing in the UK and the US. Active investing is the traditional old-fashioned style of investing where you have a manager who runs the fund. And of course, the argument that people make in favour of passive investing is that, well, a passive investor just investing in one tracker will beat quite a large percentage of active managers. And of course, that presupposes that if you're invested with an active manager that's doing a terrible job, you're going to leave it in the fund, which an active investor wouldn't do, of course. So something we do, of course, is keep a very close eye on the funds that we use, and we move money away from active investors that aren't doing terribly well. So yes, it presupposes that you would always be passive, that argument. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense, actually. It actually leads into my final question, which what are the different ways in which investors' funds can be managed and how might they benefit the client?
Well, first and foremost, of course, you can simply opt to make your own decisions and run your own portfolio. A lot of people do that with some or no advisory input. That can be relatively cheap if you know exactly what you're doing. But of course, then all of the results are down to you. Other than that, there are a couple of other ways that you can have people manage your money. So you can have your money managed on an advisory basis where you have a broker or an IFA who advises you on where to invest the money and you take that advice or you don't and you invest accordingly. That comes with a cost, of course, and you have to pay the advisor to give you that advice and you need to be sure that that's giving you value for money. And then there is discretionary investment management, which has always been the mainstay of big wealth managers like Brewin Dolphin, etc. And a discretionary investment manager will simply manage your portfolio according to a pre-agreed set of characteristics for the portfolio as he or she's fit. So you will not need to give instruction. You simply invest the money in the discretionary managed fund or with the discretionary manager, I should say, and they will manage the funds they see fit and report to you generally on a quarterly basis, telling you about the sales that they made and the gains and the losses and report to you at the end of the year. So those are kind of the three basic types. You run it yourself or you have an advisory relationship or a discretionary relationship. There are all kinds of different vehicles, of course, that people can use that you can either use yourself or have a manager use, from investment trusts to OEICs to derivative funds, all kinds of investments that essentially invest in equities. And I suppose the more you have, the more likely you are to need some kind of advisory or discretionary relationship. You know, managing your own money when you've got £10,000 or so doesn't seem quite so onerous, but when you get up to £100,000 or so, it becomes a little bit more exciting and you tend to need a little bit more help. I hope that was helpful. Thank you, Joe, for your questions. If you do, listeners, need any more information regarding equities, then we have some excellent research available on the Clarity website, and that will be attached, I believe, to wherever you find this podcast. And of course, you can always check us out on our various social media feeds. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.